You're tuned to my radio at stanpelke.com. Welcome back. I'm your host, Stan Pelke, and this is the 19th episode of readings and music from my original science fiction novel, Project Earth, Dawn of Defiance. This episode includes Interlude 4, plus the beginning of Chapter 10. It's dedicated to all my friends and listeners in the great state of New York. For more content, please visit stanpelke.com. Interlude 4.
You're listening to the Great American Radio Hour, sponsored by the Washington Avenue Bank and Trust in the heart of St. Louis. Our program begins with a dramatic reading by local actress, Miss Lorraine Carson, from the letters of Rebecca Maud Allen. The news for today, Friday, May 6th, 1927, will follow.
October 28, 1897, St. Louis. My dearest sister Olive, it is as I feared. The prognosis is not good, and I shall never again be able to travel to see you. I cried for an evening, but have found peace with the dawn. All will be well. Our bond knows no limits of time or space. Yet, sister, as I face the inevitability of my own imminent departure from this mortal world, I feel compelled to write you one more long epistle, to share things I have told no one before. For in these last months, I have found myself haunted by visitations of the men I have most loved in this life. They appear to my wakeful eyes as translucent phantoms, glowing more brightly than morning sunshine creeping round the edges of the drapes in my bedchamber. The air about them crackles with an electricity I have not felt since the years on the line, when great storms would come up from the Pacific and surge across the western face of the mountains. Oh, dear Olive, I tell myself they are but the manifestations of vivid memories flooding back into my waking consciousness from the deepest chambers of my mind, where I have, for years, tried to bury each of them. But no, they are real. I know that if I were brave enough, I could reach out my hand into the darkness and feel them, touch them, grasp hold of all as they were in life and pull them close to my aged heart. The first of these phantom men was, of course, our dear father, the Grand Reverend Timotheus Gardner. Alas, that he died so young. But I will not dwell on that sadness, for you had even fewer years to know him than I did. But it breaks my heart to think of our sweet mama, whose spirit withered after his loss, who never could love us enough for nursing her own bitterness. I see the Reverend Gardner often, haunting the spaces outside my house. Olive, he was on the bench beneath the great oak in my backyard but 2 days past, in the sparkling light of a crisp autumn morning. And he beckoned to me as I remember him doing when I was but 4 or 5, and he had some small, quaint trinket for me, some trinket that he had bought in Charleston, and that would delight us both so very much. But when I approached the place beneath the oak and said, "Papa," the phantom vanished. I sin to say it, dear Olive, but the sadness I feel toward our father's untimely death and the pleasure I take in remembering him as he was soon after your birth both pale next to the bittersweet joy I feel, thinking again of my young Major Thorpe. Oh, my sister, he died far too young, my doctor and hero from the war, the benefactor of all that came after for me. Had he not been so generous, so sure of choosing me for his wife, so lavish with the fruits of his parents' estate, what would have become of me after the war? There are moments, Olive, when I see Major Thorpe's piercing blue eyes shining in the darkness at night, and I am near blinded by their cold beauty. Do not think me a silly old woman. I tell you no falsehood. Most nights now I see those eyes as I ascend the stairs to my room above the front parlor, a room he, of course, never knew. What would draw that dear man back to me now, to this place? I have grown so old and so wizened, and yet he appears in his youthful beauty. I have forgotten now how old he was when that awful bullet took him from me. Was he yet 40? 41? It has been more than 30 years since he died, yet I knew those lovely eyes the first time they haunted me. Oh, but the Major's temper! No, sister, I will only dwell on the good. I have hidden away many memories, and it does no good to me or anyone else to think on more than needs be wrought. I will recall his eyes, the lovely shape of his face and his fine chin, the better qualities of his character, which were, after all, much more often on display than were his private outbursts of anger. I must stop my pen, or I will confess a depth of passion for that man that would make us both blush. And then there was dear General Allen. I saw the world beside that good man and husband. I have told you, Olive, twice or thrice before, that I never felt a burning passion for good Mortimer, not as I had when I was the wife of young Dr. Thorpe. But I did love the General in my own way, and he was a fine friend and companion. I shall always cherish him for having given me the opportunity to partner with him, not as mere helpmeet, but as co-equal in the construction of our magnificent railway across the mountains from California. Now I shall reveal the fourth man. I glimpsed him but once in my life, Olive, and only for a moment. I have never confessed this to you. Please do not think less of me for withholding this confession till I am near on my deathbed. You see, in that moment, that only moment, the one in which I saw him, I knew that man's soul as clearly as I perceive my own. For the rest of General Allen's life, bless his heart, that fourth man was often in my mind's eye. The General never knew this, but it did change how I felt toward him. That was an injustice I regret with all my heart. But Olive, in these last days, even that fourth man, whose name I never knew, haunts my waking hours more fully than do the others. How can this be, sister? Why must this be? When he appears, I am terrified by this apparition. Can you believe me that even now as I write to you, I see him, watching me as he stands like a shadow beside the bay window? He is stern, as such noble savages are wont to be. Yet he is never unkind. It is the act of his watching, and the intensity thereof, that so disconcert me.
Thank you.
Chapter 10, The Face in the Window. You look so much like I did at your age. Colonel T. Dijgorat, Dijsonen's father, was sitting on the bed in Dijsonen's bedroom in the great house at the center of the family's massive industrial farm and research compound near the planetary equator. The family's independent holdings occupied some of the most lush and expensive real estate in the entire solar system. Dijsonen, not yet 10 years old, had been crying. He had fallen off an open-air training vehicle and had sprained a wrist and cut his face badly in several places. A small, mechanical, medi-spider was weaving a synth skin graft over the worst of the cuts on his face. A second was slowly drawing the tiniest of pebbles, bits of sand, and grit from a gash along Dijsonen's left arm. The boy's father gently rubbed his son's back and smiled empathetically at Dijsonen. "It's all okay, son. The pain will subside when the medi-spiders are finished." Young Dijsonen shook his head and tried to swallow down some of his sobs.
It's not that,
he sniffled. "Did your grandfather reprimand you again?" T. Dijgorat stopped rubbing his son's back, and his body stiffened into a more formal pose. Dijsonen nodded quickly as more tears rolled down his cheeks. "Damn the old man," T. Dijgorat whispered harshly. One of the medi-spiders clicked irritably as the lean and handsome military man rose from the bed and walked purposefully toward the door of Dijsonen's room.
"Fasa, don't say anything."
There was a hint of panic in the child's voice.
"I'll do better next time. I know I can do better next time."
Both medi-spiders now clicked their disapproval as the boy's body became tense, ready to spring after his father. The colonel paused in the doorway and studied his son's face. "Stay here, Dijsonen." Then T. Dijgorat swept out of the room. Dijsonen was left alone with the machines, tears and fears mingling in quiet meditation. From years of experience, the boy knew that he'd still hear voices raised below in grandfather's study or further out on the edge of the great house in grandfather's private laboratory. His father would demand that the older man treat his son more compassionately. He would argue that the older man did not need to make the same mistakes with Dijsonen that he had made during T. Dijgorat's childhood. Grandfather would strike back, countering that there was no place for softness among the men of their household, not if they were going to achieve even more greatness, that a man of T. Dijgorat's military prowess should instinctively appreciate that. It was always the same fight. Dijsonen was a lonely child, though not for lack of people around him. No, there were plenty of people around. After all, his grandfather maintained a vast private farm. Some might have called it an independent state, almost 8,000 square kilometers in scale, and such an operation needed armies of people and machines to maintain it. Thousands of migrant farmers tended the vast fields of soybeans, which were destined to be processed into soy milk, tofu, and tempeh, as well as the many large orchards dotted around the huge estate. These fed grandfather's workers and the members of his private army. But there was also enough to sell off to the government to help feed thousands of other citizens. Along with his technological breakthroughs, these food stocks were one of the most important sources of grandfather's incredible wealth. But grandfather had forbidden Dijsonen to have anything to do with the men, women, and children who worked the land and tended the orchards. In point of fact, they would not have been able to get close to Dijsonen, even if they had wanted to. The main estate buildings, a mix of residential and research facilities, were clustered in the center of the family's holdings, surrounded by high, though old, stone walls, reinforced by modern security screens and military-grade shields. Nothing could approach the central compound without grandfather's explicit permission.
Dijsonen was not even allowed to go near the fields closest to the compound to watch the massive auto harvesters up close. They were the largest thinking machines Grandfather owned. He had to content himself by climbing to the upper reaches of the great house to watch those machines nearest to the compound through the rear windows via his amply goggles. He could only watch the machines on the far side of the farm through the security screens in the main command center, and then only rarely. And there were nearly 4,000 soldiers and pilots who formed Grandfather's private army. They policed and protected the farmlands, orchards, and 10 workers' villages, but Dijsonen rarely saw these men and women. Even their commanding officers were rarely seen at the main estate, as Grandfather's most trusted military commanders, who formed part of his retinue at the Great House, were more likely to go out into the fields and far reaches of the farm than were minor officers to come up to the main compound. Dijsonen did interact with the household guards, 100 members of an elite corps trained, some even bred by Grandfather, to be the family's most effective and deadly protectors. A few were fanatical in their loyalty to Grandfather, and these he kept close to himself at most times. Several of the most senior of these veterans and elite soldiers were allowed to interact with Dijsonen. Two were among his regular military tutors. Dijsonen especially liked Keltukoa, a soft-spoken, white-haired woman who trained him in marksmanship and archery. He had even been allowed to visit her private quarters, though only once, to see her wall filled with images from her youth in the service, and the many awards she had won for her sniper and assassination skills. There were the cohorts of scientists and laboratory technicians who worked in the large, freestanding laboratory complex that, along with the Great House, its ground vehicle garages, small aircraft hangar, and dormitories for soldiers and scientists, formed the core of the estate. The laboratory complex dominated the view out of Dijsonen's 3-bedroom windows on the backside of the Great House. Dijsonen did not fully comprehend what they were working on inside that structure. Much of it was kept secret, even from his father. But one wing at least was the research and manufacturing facility that produced the quantum telescope technology and spacecraft guidance systems that were the other source of Grandfather's wealth and power. Dijsonen had never been allowed in the laboratory complex, and none of the scientists, not even their chief, ever entered the Great House. When Grandfather was needed in person, he went to the laboratory, the greatest jewel in his treasury. Finally, there were dozens of artificial intelligences, some of them designed to be friendly, personal companions for Dijsonen, including his primary mathematics tutor, TW6M3. One of the most advanced personal artificial intelligences in the solar system, TW6M3 was part holograph and part machine. When interacting with Dijsonen, TW6M3's primary interface would be projected onto a wall or ceiling as a 3-dimensional holographic face, which had the appearance of something like a cat crossed with a primate. But TW6M3's thinking was done by 5 floating orbs that hovered just out of reach of the young human. Boy and artificial tutor would roam the halls, the tutor's holographic interface moving along surfaces as it drilled the boy with problems, puzzles, and equations. TW6 was uncannily able to sense the boy's moods and respond accordingly. They were as likely to stop a lesson to play multidimensional chess or take a meal when Dijsonen became overwhelmed by the work, as for TW6 to demand that he refocus for 15 more minutes. But there were no other children. And Dijsonen had no mother, not even one that he had once had, but could no longer remember. Nor did he know the love and affection of a grandmother. There were not even pictures of mother or grandmother, neither static nor otherwise, in the house. Indeed, the only picture of any woman in the entire Great House that he had ever seen was a small holographic print
of Caltucoa that hung on one wall of Grandfather's study. The Medi spiders clicked completion signals to each other and scurried away into the recesses of his bedroom. Digsonan rose, wiped his eyes and nose, forced himself to stop sobbing, and made his way into the hallway. TW6 was nowhere to be seen. Neither were any of his other mechanical or organic tutors. He made his way down the corridor to the small service stairway that led to the lower level. It was surprisingly quiet, given that he was sure his father and grandfather were arguing about him. "You drive him too hard," Digsonan heard his father say in his quiet but firm voice as he finally came into range of their voices. "I need an heir who is ready, tough of mind and body." "For what purpose? To maintain all of this?" the younger man said with a sweep of his arms in ever-expanding circles around his head and torso. "No, not for this, not for the wealth and power that I have achieved for us. For the goal, to free humanity." "Free humanity from what, Father? From your nightmare visions of social command and control?" "Yes, I must free humanity from the crushing imposition of normalcy. By escaping deeper into space? Is that so ridiculous?" The two men stared at each other for some time. They were so alike in appearance and disposition, yet even at that tender age, Digsonan was well aware of how much his father held in check in these moments of confrontation with the older man. The colonel was rigid, masterfully in command of his energies. His body almost shimmered with potential power waiting to be unleashed. "You speak of freedom, Father, yet you govern us with an iron hand. It is for the greater good. An easy excuse used, as you taught me in our studies of the social sciences when I was a child, by many a dictator in human history." "Be very careful what you say, Colonel." "My apologies, Father, but Digsonan is still a child. He needs warmth. He needs space. Time to play with other children." "You always return to this quaint yet sickening sentimentality. You must rid yourself of such feelings," the older man said with a grunt or snort as he began to pace the room. "They paralyze you from action. Tell me, how is it that the space service did not drive these base feelings from you years ago?" Grandfather stopped and turned to face his son again. "Indeed, after all these years, I still cannot fathom how a son of mine manages to feel so much, to be a slave to sentiment. After all I did to beat it out of you, you are beyond my understanding, Tidich Gorat, and beyond mine as well, Father. For here I stand, trying to reason with a man who never showed me a bit of love, let alone tenderness, and who, as you clearly so remember, tried to beat me into submission. And there it is yet again, how I hate that trite word, love. And knowing that I will have no sympathy for that appeal, you turn to tenderness. 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 Ha! Tenderness will not lead men, women, and machines, or destroy empires, or build new possibilities in distant solar systems. Tenderness. Tenderness is a mirage, another quaint holdover, like love itself, a lie used to hold us down. For all your intelligence, you cannot see, or you will not risk seeing, that each of these quaint notions of feeling and affection are instruments of control. Tidich Gorat sighed. So you have told me for as long as I can remember. And perhaps you are right, Father. But I have chosen to embrace them, chosen to be a slave to them, and thus an instrument used to prop up order and the status quo. Be that as it may, I have chosen, and I will not allow you to treat my son the way you treated me. Will not allow? Will not allow? You forget yourself, my son. For what power do you have here in my world to check my will? There was silence between them for a moment. Then Grandfather tossed up his hands and sat down in a large leather chair. What have I really done to you, Colonel? Denied you affection?
refused to hug you, failed to dry your tears. These things are irrelevant. Such affection is a bland substitute for true freedom, for real human potentialities. Have you not heard anything that I have explained to you over all of these many years? The system holds out false promises of fulfillment in love and affection, in status, and in sexual and chemical consumption, to numb us to the truth. I have heard you, Father. I have had my fill of your philosophy. Well, then you are free to go at any time, Colonel. But not Digisonin, not my boy. No, he is the price I demand for your continued connection to the service. Your words are filled with contradiction, Father. For the power you wield in this world, is it not status? And where is my freedom, or Digisonin's? You lie by claiming you are driven by a thirst for freedom. This is about the visions, your quest for the tunnel. Have you ever considered that you are delusional, or worse? Even from his hiding place, Digisonin could see how rapidly the situation changed, how quickly Grandfather rose from his chair and moved to stand nose to nose with Tejich Gorot. The elder man's hands were now tightened into fists. The two pairs of small security orbs that always floated near him had sensed the sudden change in the older man's blood pressure and adrenaline levels and had shifted locations to glide menacingly around the two men, small red lights flashing ominous and unmistakable warnings. Tejich Gorot still did not move or react or even twitch. He was too well trained by the service and too well conditioned after years of being on the margins of his own father's household. Digisonin's own body had tensed moments before to spring to his father's aid, if need be. But like a sympathetic string, he suddenly found himself resonating with the same de-escalating calm that father's stance seemed to radiate. Again, I ask your forgiveness, sir. I clearly do not have the strength of character purge myself of emotional needs, as you have done throughout your life, the colonel said softly. Nevertheless, I fear that this quest will end badly for you, for me, for Digisonin, for everyone. Then so be it. I will not betray my nerve to fail. There is no choice, colonel. I will find the tunnel and break into its secrets or die trying. And if I must first tear down or rip myself free of this system, then I will do so. The colonel carefully backed away and passed through the implied boundary of the orbit of the security orbs. He held up his hands in front of his broad chest as a sign of both surrender and respect. I will acquiesce to your wisdom once again, Father. This was an original work of music and text by Stan Pelkey. Please note that any unauthorized broadcasting, public performance, copying, or re-recording of this program, its story, or its music is an infringement of copyright.